Welcome to Off the Cuff with SDJ, a podcast about everyday life from the spiritual, the physical, and the metaphysical perspective. Each week, I'll bring you episodes that have a casual, laid-back, informal, and spontaneous look at this thing we call life. I'm Sunny Dawn Johnston. Now let's get started. Hello, Cindy.
Hi. Lovely to see you.
Yeah, so glad to have you on with us today, Cindy. We've got a beautiful audience that I'm sure are going to learn a lot and have some expansion and growth. What do you say?
Wonderful. This is the topic to expand and grow on.
It sure is. And it's a topic, as my audience knows, I like to pick hard topics, ones that are not the typical conversation. We talk about everything here on Off the Cuff. So I want to introduce you first, Cindy, so people know a little bit about you, a little bit about your background, and then we are going to dig in. Okay?
Sure.
All right. So I got to take these off. All right. So Cindy Kaufman, MEDEDS, brings her background in counselor education, as well as her more than 25 years as a hospice volunteer, to her work as a certified end-of-life doula, death educator, home funeral guide, and international best-selling author. Based in Denver, Colorado, Cindy is the owner of HeartSpeak End of Life Companioning, LLC. She serves her clients as a compassionate companion on life's final journey for those who are dying and for their loved ones as well. She is also the president and co-founder of the Colorado End of Life Collaborative, a nonprofit organization bringing visibility and education to the community about the services provided by end-of-life doulas. So excited to have you here, Cindy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So this is, I just met Cindy about 5 minutes ago, and I told her, I said, this is a conversation that I am really excited to have. And I think a lot of times, I remember, because I've also been a hospice volunteer, and when I did my training about 20 years ago, and I told people, you know, I had been with my mother-in-law when she passed, and it was the most sacred, literally really was the most sacred experience of my life. And so I came back from that, and it was just her and I. And so I came back from that, and I was like, I want to do that again. Mm-hmm. And when I would say that to people, especially 20 years ago, they would think, are you crazy? Like, there's something wrong with you, Sunny. Yeah. You want to go hang out with people that are dying? And I'm like, oh no, you don't understand. So how did you get into it, Cindy? Where did it all start for you?
Wow, such a similar situation. So mine was with my grandmother. Mm. When I was 29, it was the first time I had experienced death. And my grandmother was in an ICU unit. She was conscious and alert, and she knew she was not going to leave there. Mm-hmm. And they were going to place her in a medically induced coma so that she was in heart failure, so that when she died, she would not be in significant pain. Mm-hmm. And they gave her a couple of days to say goodbye to everyone. So we had family come from near and far and say their goodbyes. And I could not leave her bedside. Yeah. I could not leave her bedside. I didn't want her to die alone. Mm-hmm. And maybe even as importantly, I wanted to share that experience with her. Mm-hmm. And I think even then I didn't feel like she was dying. I felt like this was a part of her life. Mm-hmm. Just the final part. That's how it felt to me. She was still living. And we had these beautiful conversations, and I had this time with her that nobody else got. And I felt like it was such an education to me. And I heard other family members say, oh, how can you sit there and watch her die? And I thought, how can you not? Mm-hmm. There was just this disconnect between how they perceived being with someone at the end of life and how I was perceiving it. And it was truly life-changing for me. Mm-hmm. And when I left that situation after she died, I felt like she'd given me a gift, mm-hmm. this experience, this education that I received from her to be with her at her last breath and to be okay, right?
Yeah.
And it was painful, of course, right? At the same time, you're grieving and mourning this impending loss. But you also want to share in this experience. So it took me probably about a year. And then I was like, okay, I'm ready. I want to use what I felt was a gift in helping other people at the end of life. And I became a hospice volunteer at about 30, 31, something like that.
Yeah.
And been doing it ever since. And in all the work I've done and in all the, I've had a few different career paths in my life. This is the most, you know, being with people at the end of life is the most rewarding and fulfilling thing I've ever done. And a few years ago, I discovered the field of end of life doulas, which I didn't know existed, and realized this is me. This is what I've been doing all this time. And so it was a natural transition to move into that.
Yeah.
Career space.
Yeah. Perfect. A perfect transition for you. And so interesting. I would imagine that most of the hospice volunteers are either people that have similar stories as you just shared, or people that benefited from other hospice volunteers that witnessed the support and the healing and the love and the compassion and the kindness and want to, you know, then give back as well. Because it's such a, you know, and I agree in my experience. So I had two deaths in 6 months. I had my mother-in-law who I was with, and I had actually found out she'd had a stroke, and they had called me, and I had enough time. They said they were going to take her off of the machine so she would die immediately, they said. But one thing we know for sure is you can never, ever, ever, ever know when somebody is going to die.
It just never know.
Right?
Even in the last few hours do you ever know.
No, you can think, oh, they got a couple of days and they're gone. And then you can think, oh my gosh, they're not going to make it for 5 minutes and they last for 3 days. Like,
yes, that's a very good point. Because I have families ask me all the time when we're in that active dying phase, or that, you know, that vigil phase where we're sitting at bedside, literally waiting for that last breath. And family members and caretakers ask me, you know, how much longer do you think mom has? And I'll say, you know, I've been doing this 25 years. I have no idea.
Yeah.
And I won't pretend to guess, because if I tell you, I will be wrong.
Yes. Well, and here's the thing is, I'm a psychic medium. I deal with the death, the afterlife, and I can't tell you. I mean, it's just because it's so individual, and we don't understand. There's so many things that are getting into alignment before that happens.
Yes, absolutely.
You know?
So I
remember when I heard about after or end of life doulas, because I didn't know it was a thing. And probably maybe it was like 5 years ago, and in my realm, maybe 5-6 years ago that I heard about it. And I was like, oh, I am so glad that they have that. But and I've heard of all different kinds of stories of people that have had experiences, bringing a doula in and how life changing it really is. So in your perspective, what are, you know, if you were going to name like the three great reasons why it's helpful to have a doula, what would you say those are, Cindy?
Well, I think first and foremost, with all the experience I've had with hospice, and I'm a huge hospice proponent, but hospice over the years there's been a gap that's been created between what hospice can provide and what the caregivers, which are typically family members or friends, are providing, especially if someone's dying at home.
Yes.
And there's a gap in there. And so this gap is what end of life doulas fill. And I know some people, until they get the end of life doula, don't even realize there is a gap until they realize what end of life doulas can do. So end of life doulas have more time available to the dying person and the caregivers than the hospice team does. Mm-hmm. We're not limited in the time that we can provide and serve to that family unit. The companionship that end-of-life doulas can provide to the dying person is so incredibly valuable, especially in a family situation where the dying person doesn't feel comfortable to openly express how they're feeling about their impending death, and the ability to talk so openly and honestly, maybe they're ready, but they cannot express that to their family members because that's very hard for family members to hear sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, or they feel like they're letting them down, right?
And oh, yeah, like they've given up, or
yeah,
yeah. And the family members are sitting there say that, you know, they may say like, you know, I don't think it's going to be much longer. And the family members will say, "Don't say that," right? So they won't even let them have those conversations,
yes.
which are
yes.
So to have a doula who makes that safe space available.
Mm-hmm.
But not just for the dying person, but also for the caregivers. Maybe the caregiver needs to say, and can't say this to the dying person, "I'm really ready for my husband to go. He's right. been suffering for so long, and I'm exhausted and I feel guilty." So there's all of this emotions just so tied up in this.
Yeah.
That
is one of the big ones on either side. Guilt of,
yeah,
that's different. Maybe I didn't catch it. I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want to, you know, like it's so, and man, it's such a,
I should be doing more.
Yeah.
And then after they die, it's, I could have done more, you know, I wished I had done more. So that's to me would be the second thing, is creating that safe space for communication to happen. And then the education piece. So many people, so we talked about not knowing exactly when someone's going to take their last breath, but there are signs and symptoms that someone is approaching the active dying phase. And those signs and symptoms can be really frightening.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, not like always. Yeah. They're not always pleasant to watch because mm-hmm. You might think that person is suffering, or sometimes families want to continue to provide food and drink when the body can no longer wants
mm-hmm.
That because it is, you know, it no longer needs that sustenance. Right. And so to be there and available as an education piece to say, this is perfectly normal. You know, your loved one is going to stop wanting to take food and drink, and providing it to them isn't helpful. Mm-hmm. In fact, could be
harmful, not,
could sure. be yeah detrimental to them, because at some point they lose their swallowing ability and that. So that education piece, and typically by the time you get to that, you have built this trusting relationship mm-hmm. with the dying person and their caregivers, such that you are an incredible source and team member if mm-hmm. you've got, you. So we're not, you know, doulas don't come in instead of hospice. We come in addition to hospice because we don't provide medical care.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we do. We do some physical support. So we might be there to help with anxiety or sleeplessness or things like that. So we have some ways that we can help with physical support. But
like
emotional
what support. Kind of example, like what do you mean by physical support? So like massage or something, or do you mean?
Could be. So one of the other things about doulas is people who are drawn to doing this kind of work come from a variety of different backgrounds mm-hmm. with a variety of different skill sets.
Sure.
And so you may have massage therapists who do this work. You may have energy workers who do Reiki. You may have. So what I was thinking of when I was mentioning that was doing like guided meditation.
Okay. Because your history, your background is as a counselor. So you might be right. able to walk them through like the anxiety visualization. Sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And maybe talk about ways to improve sleep, particularly for the caregivers
mm-hmm.
And allowing themselves to use a doula as respite. Yes. Let me come in so that you can sleep.
Yes. Yes.
Take a nap. Or, you know, get out. and take a walk or get out, go to the gym.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that renews your spirit, let doulas help with that part of it too. And then the emotional and spiritual support that doulas can bring to that situation as well. Just being that trusted companion in the home during that really difficult but sacred time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sacred is the word that I use. Some of you have been with me throughout the years and you've heard me say, and I was telling Cindy this, I would generally will say that I think that the transition in from spirit into the body, birth, and from the body back into spirit, death, it's very, very similar. However, with birth, there's this anticipation of something new. Mm-hmm. With death, for everybody, there's this fear of something they don't understand. Mm-hmm. And so, and not that there isn't some fear in birth, but generally it's just like, come on, let's get the baby here. And when people are dying, they're not like, come on, let's get you gone. Like, it doesn't work that way. So the sacredness of that space and to be in the energy when someone leaves their body and enters the spirit world again is, it's such a phenomenal experience. It just is. Is that, do you experience it that way as well?
Time and time and time and time again, because it is so incredibly unique. It is so incredibly personal. Mm-hmm. That transition is uniquely personal to every individual. And, you know, so when I think about transitioning from birth into life, it's generative, right? We're going to get something out of that, like you were saying. But the similarities for me are, if you think about birth is painful, death can be painful. Mm-hmm. We labor birth, we can labor death. So, I mean, there's so much similarities in that way. That for me, I don't find it fearful in any way, even if, you know, it may not, maybe I don't share the same belief system that my client does.
Sure.
As far as what comes after, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different ways to think about that. And it's not for me to put my beliefs on anybody else. So I'm there to companion them in their own way. Mm-hmm. But even talking through that can be helpful to visualize what do you envision will happen after that last breath? Mm-hmm. And you can have that conversation with the family members too. What do you think? You know, just let's talk through that. And is there peace? Is there love? Is there light? In whatever way that shows up for that individual, and to kind of quell that fear as best that we can, that yes, there's a lot of pain around it, but there's a lot of beauty around it too.
There is.
Tremendous amount of beauty around it.
I think sometimes it's what you look for too, you know, like you're going to find whatever you're searching for. And so if you're looking for there to be pain, it's really hard to see beauty. And when you're looking to see beauty, it's hard to see the pain. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just, that's not your specific focus.
Right. If that's your expectation, you'll certainly find it.
You got it. You got it. Do you, Cindy, like I have a couple of people asking questions. So, so we have a question that says, why do we have such deep grief at their transition? So when you see, you know, you see somebody like, and I think that part of it is as we expand, like I've known people, I've had a lot of death in my life, a lot of suicides, not typical deaths, like trauma related deaths. And I think that with certain people, I don't really feel that grief because I know they're free. Like, they're free. And I'm so grateful that they're free because this life was hard for them or it was such a challenge or what have you. And I remember when my grandmother passed, I was just like smile. I was just like so excited. It was 1/11/11. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, grandma, what a perfect day. Like, good job. And so I just felt so free. But what I find is so many people, and especially when I was doing hospice work, that guilt would come in and they would feel such guilt for feeling free. You know, like if they were the caretaker.
Yes.
Oh gosh, I shouldn't feel okay that I'm okay with them going, like, and then just shame themselves for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a really beautiful topic for a doula to carry on with a caregiver is about that. What is that about? Because, and to answer the question from your viewer there too, is also just to say that I think a lot of the fear around the difficult grief around the transition is less about that person's life ending than it is our life going on without them.
Exactly.
That loss.
Yeah.
Of, you know, what will tomorrow and next week and next year be like without this loved one in my life? And it is that it's loss.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an honoring of that.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's deeply painful, but we have to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to feel it. It won't go somewhere else. You know, right. If we push it down, it's going to come out in other ways. So
for sure.
To allow ourselves to honor that of, you know, this is a tremendous loss in our life. And that to me is the pain of grief. It's what we're losing.
Right. And I think too, and I agree, Cindy, we have to feel that sadness and feel mm-hmm. that grief and feel that loss, but we don't have to stay stuck in it because what my experience now, this is from the afterlife. When they come back to me, they say, don't focus on the day I died. Focus on all the days I lived.
Absolutely.
That redirects it. Then it's like, oh, wait a minute. That's right. Your life was much more than just a death.
It was much more than that last day.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so to appreciate the experience that we had of that person mm-hmm. and the love that we shared.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And then Claire just said, when I miss someone, I light a candle in my home to honor the memory. And I love that. I do. Mm-hmm. I do that often too. I have a candle, that's by my kitchen and I have, like I said, many people in the spirit world. And so sometimes I'll just light it and I'll say, okay, Grandma, I'm inviting you to dinner tonight. Okay, Mike, you're going to come and party with us tonight, whatever it happens to be. Like, you know, we're having a celebration, and it's just kind of a human way of just saying, okay, I see that spark in you, because that spark still exists somewhere, and I'm just calling you in.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful way to do it. Yeah. Let's invite everyone to dinner. We'll light 3 or 4 candles, right?
Exactly. I'd have a whole fireplace going for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
So when you talk about death, so, you know, I've been teaching and talking and speaking about hospice and then the afterlife for over 20 years. You as well, you said about 25.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people just shut down with the death conversation, right? Because that's what's associated with it is pain. How do you help people to overcome, or how do you bring the conversation so that it's, and you used a word, I liked it. Death can lead to dying well and then living well. So how do you redirect that? I mean, I oftentimes bring the spirit aspect in, and then they're still with us and that type of thing. But for you, it isn't, as a doula, you don't really get to incorporate your belief systems, whatever those may be. So it's kind of meeting people where they are. But when it's specific to just death in general, how do you overcome that, the culture that we live in right now?
The culture we live in is really tough. We have a death phobic. We have a death phobic culture.
Yes.
And a lot of things contribute to that, but one of them is the fact that we simply don't see death anymore. Mm. We don't see it. You know, people die in hospitals, and, you know, our elderly folk are in nursing homes, and, you know, we get a call that grandma died and we weren't there. We weren't, And also we're just this mobile culture now, right? People live, families are spread out across the United States and maybe they're not close enough to be there and experience a death. But, and then as soon as someone dies, they're whisked off to the funeral home. Mm-hmm. And then the next time we see them, they're made up to look like they did when they were living. And so we don't really, we don't have experience with it.
Sure.
So I kind of get why people are afraid of it, because we don't see it. We don't talk about it. We don't acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. We certainly don't talk to our kids about it. We really shelter children from death. Mm-hmm. You know, if their pet dies.
Right, because it's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable. If we're uncomfortable, we're not going to be able to talk to our kids about it.
Right. And sometimes our kids don't like. The other day, my son was over. I have a 22-year-old and a 30-year-old. My 22-year-old came over, and I said something to him. I said, "Oh, honey, I'm trying to get your dad to clean this shop up, because when we're gone, this is going to be your mess." And he's like, "Don't talk like that." And I'm like,
"No, don't say that.
That's going to happen. We are going to go one day, and this mess is probably still going to be here." So, you know, so I think bringing it out in the open, right? Like just talking about the realities of life and the realities of death are important.
Well, one of my favorite sayings is talking about sex won't make you pregnant. Just as talking about death won't kill you. So
that is a good one, Cindy.
We're not going to bring it on just by having a conversation about it. But I do truly believe that the more comfortable people can get mm-hmm. with talking about end of life and preparing for the end of life,
yes.
if we do our preparation for it, then we can live well mm-hmm. because it's not something that we're putting off. It's not something that we're avoiding. It's not something that we sit in fear of.
Yeah.
If we face it, you know, and then, you know, anytime anyone has an opportunity to sit with someone at the end of life, I greatly encourage people to do that, mm-hmm. no matter how fearful it seems, because you come out feeling very differently.
Sure do.
Everyone I've ever talked to. Yep. Everyone I've ever talked to, it changes you.
It does. It literally, well, to be quite honest, the death that when I was with my mother-in-law, so that was 20 years ago, this month, might've even been this day. It was right here in this time. That was 20 years ago. And it changed the direction of my life for the rest of my life. The reason mm-hmm. that we are having this conversation right now, the reason that I do the work I do, the reason that I'm on written the books I've written, all of it is because of that experience. That's what started. Now, not I had lots of experiences before that, but that was the one that once I was with her when she transitioned, and again, I got to be with her, and I was holding her hands. I'd climbed up in bed with her, mm-hmm. and you know, she couldn't communicate, but mm-hmm. we were telepathically communicating. And when she transitioned, I felt her spirit move through my body to the point that I literally was shaking so much, not from fear, but just mm-hmm. shaking from that energy that I couldn't
see energy.
For a half hour probably. But when I did, I stood up a different person. And mm-hmm. then I like to say she haunted me from the other side and said, "Sunny, it's time to do your work. No more screwing around." Right? So
yeah.
I think it changed your life. It's crazy.
It did.
I mean, it's remarkable, you guys. If you ever have that opportunity, don't shy away from it. Such a beautiful experience.
And we're not saying it's easy.
No,
it's not easy. Mm-mm. But just know that there is beauty in it. There is sacredness in it. There is a life-changing experience to be had.
Yes, there is. Sure. And do you think that do you think that it's just our culture that causes people to pull away? Or do you think that there is an ingrained, do you think that there's an energy that kind of just comes with the sense of knowing that, okay, this might be the last time I see this person? Or do you think it's the societal training that we have or a little bit of both that keeps us so reserved, distant?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's like this multi-layered onion, you know, and also I think about how perhaps our religious teachings have an impact on it.
Sure.
You know, if you have been told that, you know, sinners go to hell, mm-hmm. and you haven't lived, a life that you are happy with.
Yeah.
Which happens to a lot of people. They get to the end of their life and they realize this. And the fear is about where they're going after that transition.
Yes.
And so this is why I like to combine the living well, dying well talk, because in living well, you're preparing for dying well too. The way that you live your life is what you're going to reflect back on. If you don't have a traumatic death and you do have an opportunity to reflect back on your life in the last days and maybe months of your life, I've never heard a single person in all these years that I've sat with at the end of life talk about how they wished they had worked harder, mm-hmm. achieved more, mm-hmm. you know, made more money, yeah. accumulated more things. This is not where we focus at the end of our life. What yeah. we focus on is how we lived our life, how we loved, and how we were loved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amen.
And the only thing we want to be surrounded by at the end is those people we've loved who love us. Mm-hmm. That is what matters. And so if we live our life in accordance with that,
yeah,
you don't have, so I did my training with the International End of Life Doula Association, and Henry Fersko Weiss is the founder and director of that organization. And in my training with Henry, he talks about the, no, I'm going to get it wrong. Give me just a second to think about what it is.
Okay. The rugs
at the end of life, which are the regrets, the unfinished business, the guilt, and the shame. Mm-hmm. And waiting until you get to the end of your life to deal with those things may be too late.
Yeah, yeah.
You may not have time to remedy those things and to come to some, feeling that you've dealt with it or completed that work or
some of some sort.
Yeah. So in the book that I wrote, I talk about how that becomes part of living well, mm-hmm. in preparation for dying well. Yes. And when I talk about dying well, I don't use it in the way of that, well, here's a recipe for what you should do.
Right.
It's more looking at what's important to you in your life. Mm-hmm. What kind of person do you want to be at the end when you look back?
Right.
And how can you live that life without?
Now.
Yep. Without the shame and the guilt and the unfinished business and the regrets.
Yeah,
because that's
today, guys. You hear that, yep. about living today in the way that you truly desire to be, so that your tomorrows, whenever that does come, that mm-hmm. you are settled and present and not in a place of coulda, shoulda, woulda.
Yeah, because that makes for very complicated death, mm-hmm. for the dying person.
Yes.
When and this is their reflection
too, because I've been,
oh, hit. Sure.
The complications. Oh my God. And then what happens after the death? Woo! Oh boy. There's a lot that goes on in that. So we have to be, and there is an energy. I think when you are more responsible on this front end, then you are a part of the creation of the end.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it is our end, and we should be a part of that creation.
Yes, for sure.
Whenever that's going to come. And that's the whole thing. That's the whole mystery of life, is we don't know when that's going to come.
Exactly.
Or how that's going to come.
Yeah.
So
let me ask you this. So I'm blessed. I'm a minister. And so I'm blessed.
Well, am I?
I have done a lot of funerals, probably about 100. And weddings. I marry them and bury them. That's what I say. I marry them and bury them.
Kindred sisters.
All right, girl. So when I, having the opportunity to, again, in positions where people are like, why would you want to do that? To me, I'm like, to honor somebody's life and, mm-hmm. and not get up there and tell bullshit stuff. 'Cause that's not really what I'm about. Like real stuff. Right. But in being a minister and having done so much of the, you know, hospice work and then being there connected with the afterlife, tell me a story. Tell me one story that you have that's like one of your great, you know, like when you were with them and it was transitioning, was there something that happened that was really cool or that was shocking or that was, you know, obvious that spirit was like in the house or something that kind of stands out to you? Because I think that a lot of times people, if they have something that they know or that makes them make sense to go, oh, they are here. Oh, they are okay. Like they're still around or what have you. That a lot of times that brings a sense of peace that then people can move on with. So do you have something that's a interesting one, or you thought they weren't going to, they were on hospice and they were going to pass and then they just never did, or, you know, like, things like that. Cause that does happen. They, right. They get a hospice and then they just.
Like, it absolutely does happen. Mm-hmm. And just as a little aside, when I see that happen most is when someone's been in a nursing home and they're considered terminally ill and they're getting close to active dying and they might move them into hospice. And then the care increases such that person actually improves and no longer qualifies for hospice. And then, unfortunately, sometimes it can be this revolving door. They go back to the nursing home and the same thing happens again. It's just, it's where the care is. Mm-hmm. So people do improve on hospice care, and that's just because of the level of care they get. But you know, when you were asking me that, the first thing that came to my mind was I was helping a granddaughter care for her grandmother. She had taken her grandmother into her home. Her grandmother had been in a nursing home, and she felt like her grandmother was not getting the best of care and she was dying. And so she brought her into her home to care for her. And so I started working with them. I was mostly providing respite and a bit of companionship for the grandmother, but she didn't have a lot of time left. So I didn't get to build a deep relationship with her, but I would provide respite for the granddaughter so she could get out. And the grandmother got sent to an inpatient hospice unit for a more extended respite stay. You can do that for about 5 days on Medicare so that the caregiver can get a break. So the granddaughter, she and the grandmother was having, they were having trouble getting her pain under control. So she went into inpatient hospice and I went there to visit her. And when I walked into the room, there was a young man sitting there visiting her who I had not met. And so I introduced myself and it turned out he was the brother. This was the grandson, the brother of the granddaughter who was caring for her. So this was the grandson. And he had come from out of town knowing that his grandmother had been hospitalized. And he came to visit and he said, I'm here until she dies because I don't think this is going to be much longer. And the grandmother was unresponsive. And I went over and acknowledged her and I whispered in her ear and I let her know that I was there and I had come to see her and that I was going to visit with her grandson for a bit. But again, she didn't respond back to me. And I could see this emotional turmoil going on in the grandson. And so I sat on the edge of the bed. He sat in a chair next to the bed and I sat on the edge of the bed and I started to have a conversation with him. And this was the second death in a year that he was preparing to be present for. And the first was his mother-in-law that they had cared for in his home and she had died like 6 months before. So a lot of death. Mm-hmm. In a short period of time for this young man who had a young family himself. And then the conversation really went to self-care. I asked him, how are you caring for yourself as the caregiver? How are you caring for yourself? What are you doing to make sure that you have the energy to enter this situation now with your grandmother, you know? And so we were in this conversation and he got tearful and all of the sudden, her breathing changed, the grandmother. And she was not expected to die that day. Mm-hmm. again, we talk about, do you know when this is going to happen? Don't have any idea when this is going to happen. But she was not expected to die that day. In fact, she was expected in a couple of days to go back to the granddaughter's house and die there. That was what was thought would happen. And as we're sitting there having this very emotional conversation, her breathing changed rapidly. Mm-hmm. And so I attended to that to see what was happening. And I looked at the grandson and I said, your grandmother is passing. Mm-hmm. So we notified the hospice nurse, and just as she was taking her last breaths, the other grandchildren walked in the room.
Yeah.
And so they were present, mm-hmm, as she took those final two breaths, and I was present and her grandchildren were present. Mm-hmm. And to be with this older grandmother and her younger grandchildren, they're all grown and have families, but you know, 30s and under. Mm-hmm. And then one of the granddaughters very quickly reached over and opened the window. She said, yeah, we have to do this to let the spirit out. Uh-huh. And so I then became this observer in the room to watch the different ways in which the different personalities, mm-hmm, reacted. They all had just experienced their grandmother's last breaths. Mm-hmm. And to see, some were very stoic and quiet, and some were outwardly expressing their grief on their knees at the bedside. And you talk about sacred experiences. I felt so honored to be allowed to be in this space with this family,
yeah,
at this moment in time where I just came to visit her. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what was planned for that day.
Yes.
And so I've learned not to plan.
Nope. Cannot.
I've just learned not to plan. I felt like the grandmother picked her moment.
Yeah, for sure.
I did. I genuinely felt like she picked her moment as she heard this conversation, mm-hmm, that she was not going to let her grandson go through any more of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I'm going to protect him now.
Yeah. I love that. I could listen to stories like this because they happen all the time.
Yes, right? They do.
I mean, I'm sure you've got hundreds. I want to share one real quick because I'm going to do the exact opposite of that. Because one of the questions I get a lot is why they wait until you're there, or why, mm, they wait until you leave. Like, you go to the bathroom and then they die while you're, yep, in the bathroom. So one of my stories that is similar but different is I was called to the bedside of a client of mine, and she had been not eating for 10 days. They thought she was going to go, and she was still hanging on. And so they're like, Sunny, please come and tell us why she's holding on, you know, what's going on. And so I went, and I, you know, she wasn't communicative, but I went and I telepathically talked with her and climb up in their beds. That's what I do, I guess. So I climbed up in her bed, I talked with her, and I said, who is it that hasn't been here? And they said, oh, her brother, he won't come. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, she's waiting for him, because, mm-hmm, that's what she told me. And, mm-hmm, they said, well, he won't come. And I said, well, then she ain't going to die. that's she's a stubborn woman. She is not going to go. So, yeah. I said, would you just call him and just tell him that because he knew who I was, that I just had a conversation with her. I know that sounds weird, but I did. And she's telling me she's waiting for him and she's not going to go without him coming. And so the daughter did. And I stayed there for about an hour and a half, and the daughter called and she said, no, he said he isn't coming. And I had I think he's going to come. So about an hour later I left and I said, call me this evening and let me know, you know, how she's doing. If he would just come, she'll go. So the brother decided, this was such, oh my gosh, I get goosebumps. So the brother finally decided, okay, I better, like, he didn't want to get, he thought he was going to have something bad was going to happen to him if he didn't. So he's like, I better go. So he went in the house, he popped his head in and he said, hey, and then he went into the bathroom, to probably pull himself together before he actually walked in and saw her. And she died. She died while he was in the bathroom. Nobody was with her, but the so then this was the story behind the story. Because see, that's the thing, is you don't always know why they're holding on. So I they called me and they said, oh my God, Sunny, she, as soon as he walked in, she died. I said, she was waiting for him. But the, behind the story was that he had, his mother had died 10 years earlier and she was really sick. She'd been on hospice. She was getting really close. And he had decided to go on a motorcycle trip that he had had planned for 6 months. So he went on the motorcycle trip. She died while he was on the motorcycle trip. He never forgave himself and he never rode a motorcycle again.
Oh, wow.
So his sister was not going to let him use her as his excuse. Like, she was going to heal this piece, right?
Yeah. So
it was such a cool experience. And so to me, so obvious that it might not seem this way, but they go when they're supposed to go. Mm-hmm. Whether you're in the room, you're not in the room. If you weren't in the room, they didn't want you there. If you were in the room, they did want, like, it. They choose that timing. And it's, and I think it's an agreed on time from the beginning, from the way I understand it. But those kinds of stories, and I bet you see, because I've seen so many of them, I bet you have too. It's just like, gosh, that's cool.
Oh, and I see people hanging on way longer than you think physically is possible.
Yes. And you don't understand it because you don't know all of the complexities.
That's exactly it. And so if I've got family members present, we will have that conversation because I don't typically know their life history. Yes. I know a lot about them by that point, but I may not know what it is specifically. So if you start, you know, hashing this out with the family members, like, is there something that she might be possibly holding on for?
Yes. Yes.
And what might that be? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And I find this a lot more with younger adults when they die, that they tend to hold on.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's with a death that is out of place in time.
Yeah.
It's too early.
Like a young, so they're giving closure to everybody, giving them the opportunity to have that closure or something. So
or they just simply aren't ready to leave their loved ones.
Right. And that's, you know,
because it's so early.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. We could talk for hours, Cindy, because this is such a topic that, this is so much part of my life. I love it. I love it.
I know when we're laughing and giggling and people are like, wasn't that a death conversation? And
it was, but that's the thing. Death is a part of life.
It is a part of life.
There are
humorous parts about it. And, you know,
there are life, absolutely. So tell us about your book, because you've got your book behind you. I want to know, because people are saying, I want to order the book.
This just came out in May. So this is The Mortal's Guide to Dying Well, Practical Wisdom from an End-of-Life Doula.
Beautiful.
And it really is focused. So I do share the story of my grandmother, because my grandmother really is the life-changing event that sent me to even writing this book. Mm-hmm. So I do talk a lot about living well. There are some worksheets in the back where you can sort of take a look at, how are you? What are your values? And you know, what are the ways in which you think about living well? And are you living in accordance with that? And if not, what changes might you need to make so that you don't have the regrets, the unfinished business, the guilt, the shame at the end of life? Let's not do that, right?
Yeah. Let's skip that part.
Let's not do that. Mm-hmm. And I talk a little bit about how funerals have changed, how the funeral industry is changing. In this country, more people are wanting to take back community care on doing home funerals where they're cared for, the after-death care is done by the family, or even the friends in the community come together to help with that, and they funeral in the home. So home funeral guides is another new area that people are working in, and it's because it's become so separated from the experience of living and dying in our culture, again, contributing to that death phobia. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of a lot of good stuff in here.
Yeah.
In what looks like a small book, but it covers a lot.
Can you get it on Amazon, Cindy?
It is on Amazon.
Okay. Or do you have it on your website or something as well?
So I have it on my website too. My business website. So my business is HeartSpeak, all one word, HEARTSPEAK. My website is HeartSpeak, the number two, the letter U, HeartSpeak2U.com. Or it's on Amazon. And I have a Facebook page, The Mortal's Guide to Dying Well, also.
Perfect. So you can find her in all of those areas. Because here's the one thing that's absolutely guaranteed is we're all on our way to death.
Every one of us.
Every single person. We're all on we're on our way there. So if that makes you happy, let me just be your sunshine for a moment. Because here's the thing. It's something that is absolutely guaranteed.
Absolutely. We are both living and dying at the same time.
We sure are. Yeah. And there's a lot of things that you can be doing. And in addition to, you know, the emotional work and maybe cleaning up some relationships and preparing your estate and being able to get a trust in order and have some of the things set up that you want so that you can feel that that there isn't the pressure when that time comes. Because when that time comes, it's not usually what you're thinking about.
No, and not to put that pressure on your family of not having a plan either.
Right.
It's a chaotic time for your family members to wonder, did he want to be buried, cremated? I don't know. We never had this conversation. That there's so much emotion around that time that to have those things in order for your family is a gift.
Yes.
It's a gift for you to prepare. It's a gift to your family to prepare as well. And we should all be doing it. I don't care what age you are. 18 and over, we should all be doing it.
Yeah. And it seems, you know, you guys might be 35 years old and you're like, I'm healthy. I can give that 30 years. But here's the thing is that's something it perfectly said, Cindy. It's a gift you give to your family. I also think that what I see and I deal a lot with this afterwards is people really struggle to feel like they're making the wrong decision. Oh, she might not have wanted me to do this. She did want me to do this. I didn't do that. I didn't know I should do it. Like all of those things. So then they live in their own questioning, guilt, and shame. And I, interestingly enough, I have on my phone right here, I have about 10 of my close family and friends, their death wishes, meaning literally what they want, how they want it, what song they want played, where they want the cash.
I love this so much.
Because we just have these, I know that you guys are like, I don't want to be a friend of yours, Sunny, because these are the conversations that we have.
Actually, you do want to be a friend of Sunny's because you know what? Sunny is going to make sure that that gets done for you, that your wishes get,
So those are important, but I guess what I'm wanting you guys to understand is it might seem like, but I'll just do that down the road, but then oftentimes down the road doesn't come because the situation comes.
Yes.
And so not to be doing it from a fear-based place either, but this is a conversation that like I sat at the campfire with my sister-in-law and brother-in-law and my husband, and we were talking about these different places and they're like, well, I don't know who's going to know. And I'm like, I got notes. I got it written down. Don't you worry. I got that one. I will take care of that for you.
That's fabulous. No, I think we plan everything in our life, but we don't plan this.
Yeah.
And this is definitely going to happen. Why do we not plan for it?
Exactly.
So there are some worksheets in the back of my book too that help you plan for how you want that to be and look and feel. All of that. So this helps people think through that. Mm-hmm. And these worksheets can be taken out and placed in with your will, your living will, all your advanced care planning documents, and then let someone know where those are, provide a copy to somebody, and then you're all good. Go live your life and be well.
Yeah.
And live well. Yeah.
Live well and die well. Okay. I'm going to ask you just a couple of off the cuff questions just for fun. So we get to see a little different side of you. Okay.
Yep.
What is the most exciting thing you've ever done?
Ooh, I have to pick one.
A little adventuresome, are you?
Oh, I went and lived for a year in Brazil.
That was
fun. That was really exciting because I didn't know, you know, they speak Portuguese in Brazil. I didn't know the language. I tried to learn it. But, you know, when you get to be a certain adult age, it's very hard to learn a new language. Your brain just isn't wired that way anymore.
Yeah.
And it's a tough language to learn. So I became a very humbled individual living in a culture where I could not speak the language. Couldn't communicate with people, couldn't ask directions. And we were there because my husband did a academic sabbatical year there, but we lived in a town where no one spoke English. Huh. And it was a humbling experience, and it was exciting. Mm-hmm. I have exciting stories where we thought we were being chased by a motorcycle gang and turned out to be completely something different. But again, I couldn't communicate. And I thought I was in this frightening situation. That is not what that was at all. So, it was a wonderfully exciting year full of new experiences and meeting fabulous people. The Brazilian people are just beautiful people and welcoming. And we have wonderful friends that came from that experience. So
I love that experience. That's a great one. Beautiful. Yeah. Okay. What is something that you have purchased in the last year that you cannot live without?
It's so hard because the first thing that came to my mind is I've been stuck in my house for 5 months.
I know, right? Then you only pick 7 months.
I bought a new car earlier this year that I absolutely love, and I haven't driven it. It's not getting any mileage on it.
Yeah.
And I bought because I thought it would be so fun. In my work as an end-of-life doula, I'm all over the place. Mm-hmm. And in my hospice volunteering, I'm in people's homes. So I'm all over the city all the time, except for the last few months because I haven't been able to serve in people's homes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so my car has been sitting. But I bought this camera for my front windshield. Because in all of my driving around the Denver area, I always see the funniest, weirdest things that people will never believe. So I thought I'm going to put a camera.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to video a car that did this or somebody on the sidewalk that did that. Uh-huh. And so the other day, my husband said, "Do you ever use that camera?" And I said, "No, because I don't use my car.
I haven't been anywhere.
Yes. Yes. So I'm excited to be able to drive the car and use the camera one day soon.
Anticipation, right?
Yeah.
Anticipation.
Yeah.
All right, my friend, it was so great to meet you. I love this conversation. We had a lot of people that were not quite sure about it, and I think they were happy to join us. So go and make sure you get the book, The Mortal's Guide to
Dying Well.
Dying Well. You can grab it on Amazon, grab it on her website, check it out. And guys, again, it's just important to create. You'll feel so much better when you have things in order. You know, there's a question here, and I don't know if you know this answer or not, but let's just check. Do your last wishes and plans have to be notarized?
They do not.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't think they did. You can notarize them if you want to feel like it's more legal, but it's not really going to matter as long as you have a signature on there. And
what's most important is that somebody knows where to find it so that they can honor it for you. So yes.
Yes. And that the person that you want to find it is the person you trust to honor it for you.
Also. Absolutely.
Yes. Awesome. Okay. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Cindy. It was beautiful to have you on. And I'm glad you guys all joined us. I hope it expanded your mind a little bit. As all of you know, that's why I do these off the cuffs. I like to bring in different guests and change makers in the world that are making a difference and creating a ripple. And with all unique conversations, and certainly death is one that is unique for a lot of people. So thank you, Cindy, for doing the work you do. I appreciate you. Thank you, everyone. Have a good one. Thank you so much for listening to Off the Cuff with SDJ. If you gained some knowledge, if you felt a connection, if you got some ahas or insight into this thing we call life, if you feel like you're a little more elevated than you were before you listened to this podcast, then please subscribe to this podcast. And if you're already signed up, please rate and review it. I'd greatly appreciate it. If you want to get more information about me and what I have to offer, go to my website, sunnydonjohnston.com. Thanks so much, my friend, and I hope to see you next week.